Гибридная война – это уникальная методика.
Это война гибридная, без явных боевых
действий. Гибридная война – термин, который может...
Гибридная война не предполагает всеобщего.
Гибридная война. Что это такое?
All hybrid wars, it appears, are not created equally. Some, like the one Russia's been waging on Ukraine, are expressly designed to go kinetic and result in a shooting war. And others, like the one Russia's been waging on the West, are designed to remain non-kinetic, aimed at dividing, demoralizing, and distracting. Both forms are dangerous, both forms can be deadly, and both forms are here to stay. So what can the West do about it? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Eliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of a new report, Hybrid War or Gibridnaya Vyna, Getting Russia's Nonlinear Military Challenge Right. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
So, Mark, what exactly have we been getting wrong in the hybrid war debate?
Well, let me pull back to this point about there being two kinds of war, because I think that is absolutely crucial to understand what's not being done. What we lump together, or what we have tended to lump together in the past under this term hybrid war, which isn't even a Russian term, is exactly this sort of genuine military struggle and then the essentially political war that they're trying to wage against the West. And the trouble is that when we confuse the two, when we too easily assume that the political struggle being waged against the West is just simply a prelude for little green men popping up in Narva or whatever, then what that means is we focus on the military. And that's obviously an important element and right and proper that we do it. But it means we have been missing out on many of the non-kinetic responses that we need to address. We still haven't, especially not on a Europe or NATO-wide basis, really begun to tackle the issue of dealing with Russian espionage, something we've talked about in the past. Mm-hmm. We've still got the problem of financial transactions that just too easily flow, which means that the Russians can develop their Chornaya Kassa funds, their black accounts, and use them to support all kinds of divisive and dubious political movements. And obviously we come back to the whole issue of disinformation, although I think, again, it's slightly overblown, but nonetheless it clearly plays a part in all of this. So, you know, one can go on and on and on.
And corruption and state capture and elite capture. And
you know,
so on.
I mean, I don't want to give you the full 25,000 words of the report, but that's the point. I think the thing is that we get distracted by the military issues, which firstly are a big ticket, and therefore they tend to kind of consume a lot of money. Secondly, though, they are evident and visible. You know when you bought a new missile system. It's there. You know what it can do. And so we tend to get seduced by the comfortable metrics of military power. And in the process, we miss out on the non-kinetic.
Mm-hmm. What else have we been getting wrong? Is that the distinction, the main thing that's been getting wrong? Because that is an original contribution there. I haven't seen this distinction made, and it rings very true that these are two different types of campaigns. The type that Russia's been waging in Ukraine, which was clearly intended to go kinetic, and the one that's going on in the West, which is not intended to go kinetic, but is intended to destabilize, but is a war nonetheless.
It's a war nonetheless, exactly, but a totally different kind of nonlinear war. And obviously, because the two tend to use very similar instruments up to a point, mm-hmm. that's why we tend to think of them the same. But if one looks actually at the Russian military writings on this, and a lot of it started with a particular article by Chief of the General Staff Gerasimov, actually what they are describing is not just purely a political struggle. They're describing precisely a sense that in the modern era, you can do so much with non-kinetic methods before you send in the tanks and the troops. But if one actually looks at how Russia plans to fight wars, it plans to fight them in the good old-fashioned way, mm-hmm. with massive shock and awe offensives. Now, we don't face that unless something disastrous happens in the West, the complete collapse of NATO and the European Union or whatever. But even then, I mean, there's little evidence that there's any advantage to be gained from Russia by any territorial expansion. So the thing is, what we have to realize is what we face is precisely a campaign to basically render us impotent, render us incapable of responding on a political or economic or other kinds of levels. And that's a different kind of threat. And I think that is an absolutely crucial point, because otherwise we spend all our time watching for little green men who are never going to appear, and we're not looking at the little invisible men who are already here.
Right. Now, a lot of ink has been spilled on this concept over the last since 2013, 2014, since the Ukraine crisis started. What moved you to put this out now, and what did you find? What were your main findings in here?
Well, I think in part, precisely, I was beginning to... I mean, obviously, in 2014, Crimea came as a shock to everyone. Not just that the Russians were actually going to go ahead and steal a part of another country, but actually the relative speed and efficiency with which they carried it out. And it showed us that they'd been building certain capacities that we hadn't really taken on board. And that's why, again, at first there was, an overhyping of hybrid war. And in some ways, I was also contributing to that overhyping too. The very notion of something called the Gerasimov Doctrine, which I used very early on, and I meant it just as a snappy title for a blog post, and it became used. And it's not. It's not Gerasimov's. It's not a doctrine. But that doesn't matter. Unfortunately, a snappy term becomes used. But it became increasingly clear, particularly, I would say, from 2015 onwards, the nature of Russia's campaign was essentially aggressively defensive, in the sense of it was trying to keep the West out of the areas that it regarded as its important sphere of influence, primarily but not exclusively Ukraine. And that's what got me actually thinking, well, no, it's time to actually dig a little bit deeper and do two things. One is obviously go into the often highly, highly tedious Russian military writings, but nonetheless are there precisely as Russians themselves try to grapple with how war is changing. But secondly, to actually talk to people, experts and people within the security field in Moscow. Because up to this point, essentially, this had been a debate between Western experts as to how we interpreted certain Russian writings and certain Russian actions and sayings. We hadn't really been going in and saying to Russians, OK, what do you make of this? I mean, this is the key thing that struck me talking about this concept of Gibridnaya Voina, is that the very fact that the Russians didn't have their own term for it, and every time I spoke to a Russian about it, they always talked it as the Western tactic of operational art of Gibridnaya Voina.
Well, now you have a whole section here on the hybrid war through Russian eyes, and what is it through Russian? What does this look like through Russian eyes?
Well, through Russian eyes, it's precisely what they have, and obviously I would want to stress that I'm telling you what they're telling me rather than what I actually believe. But they look at a whole series of developments in the modern world, particularly the color revolutions that we saw, in post-Soviet space and the Arab Spring. And they see the West and above all the United States as fingerprints in them. They see, as far as they're concerned, that the West has developed a complex new way of basically destabilizing and bringing down regimes they don't like. And clearly, from their point of view, on the one hand, they're worried about it being directed towards themselves. But on the other hand, they're thinking, oh, shiny, this is something that they themselves would want to adopt. Let's be honest, so much of Russian, just like Soviet military art, is catching up with how they think the West is thinking.
And doing to the West what they think the West has been doing to them.
So when you look at if you start from that point of view, however false, and yet you nonetheless unleash a lot of often very, very smart individuals to try and say, well, okay, how do we do this? They started looking at how the modern world works, again, through Russian eyes, looking at the interconnectedness of capital, looking at the way that modern media is now so open to being abused and manipulated, looking at the way that, in fact, the West is so thoroughly divided and currently mired in its own crises. And so they looked at the modern world through this perspective of thinking, well, we've now been given this toolbox by the West. How can we apply it most effectively?
So it's interesting. What jumps out as you were talking, I think this is all based on a false premise, essentially, that the West, you say the West's fingerprints were all over the colored revolutions. I mean, I guess you could make that argument in that the West is doing what the West does. It supports civil society groups, as the West always has been. But that doesn't mean it was an attempt to create a revolution. But based on this false premise, the Russians created an entire doctrine about how to do this to the West.
And I think, first of all, let's be perfectly honest, the West is not always just simply the shining bastion of freedom and so forth. We have been known.
No, but I don't think there was a plot to overthrow the Ukrainian government or the Georgian government.
No, absolutely not. But the interesting thing is that exactly from this false premise, What is clear is the Russians have identified a lot of very real and uncomfortable facts about the modern world. I mean, in some ways, exactly. They started from there, and they've actually, in my opinion, they are the first to fully understand how warfare is going to be in the 21st century. Mm. Again, we tend to look at the technologies. We think, oh, this is going to be a war of drones and, you know, robot beasts bringing ammunition resupplies and 3D printers and all this kind of thing. Well, actually, the truth of modern warfare is, first of all, it's ridiculously expensive. It's in purely financial terms. And it's also expensive in the sense of modern democratic societies are, and I think this is a good thing, not very tolerant of casualties. We're not happy with seeing thousands of our boys coming home in body bags. So you've actually got the fact that the war is now really expensive. War is also incredibly basically destructive when it is actually waged in full terms. And at the same time, you actually have, because the world is so interconnected, we're now so vulnerable to everyone else. I mean, in some ways, cyberspace has become a metaphor. I mean, just as in cyberspace, anyone can reach anyone else easily and from their bedroom somewhere. Well, so too, actually, in economics, in social, in media, in informational terms. Nowadays, we are all so interconnected, and therefore we are all so vulnerable.
Mm. Now, you talk about the roots of this, and it's essentially rooted in Russian weakness, essentially, right? This decision to go to deploy this form of warfare was rooted, essentially, in, how do you put it, the gap between aspirations and capability.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. On the one hand, Russia regards it, one has to be fair here, Putin and the Putin regime regards it as axiomatic that Russia somehow deserves still to be a great power. And we saw that coming actually out in Putin's State of the Federation speech yesterday, which I know we'll be talking about later. So on the one hand, you know, Russia must be a great power. And yet Russia is not a great power. In some ways, President Obama, when he called it a regional power, very much earning the bristles of Putin and co., was actually being in some ways generous in his assertion. I mean, actually, Russia has striking lack. I mean, it has very little soft power, except with a handful of kind of wannabe Putin leaders. But certainly societies on the whole do not want to be Russian style. Its economy is in crisis and will continue to be, even if actually GDP begins to start inching up next year.
And we're talking about a GDP which is roughly the size of the market capitalization of the top three corporations in the world combined, which is not...
Exactly.
Much,
right? This is not the stuff of which global superpowers are made.
It's less than California, New York, or Texas.
And if you look at the dynamism, the innovation capacity, all that kind of thing of this system, it's very, very poor. So when you put that together, what have they got? Well, they have a certain amount of military force that Putin has been spending a lot of money into developing. And perhaps most importantly, they have a will to use it and a will to actually break the rules of the international system, both because they think the international system is essentially a Western construct designed to keep Western interests to the fore, but also because this gives them an edge of initiative. So I think, yes, absolutely, that is the key thing. When you have nothing else, you are like a guerrilla. I call this guerrilla geopolitics, that obviously you're not going to try and fight your struggle in the areas in which the other side is strongest. You're going to try and find their weaknesses and bring the battle there. But at the same time, I mean, the other elements, apart from the fact that how the world has changed, is also the Bolshevik tradition. I mean, it's also the fact that we have to look at the extent to which the current Russian toolbox is in so many ways rooted in the old Soviet toolbox for destabilization, subversion and propaganda. Now, the big difference is that in the Soviet times, there was at least an attempt to give it a positive message. They were genuinely committed as a system to spreading Marxism-Leninism around the world. Now, Putin isn't interested in spreading anything except chaos, division and despair. It's all about undermining rather than replacing.
So why were they so unsuccessful then? And they, at least from the vantage point of right now, they appear to be very successful right now. Because if you look at what we've seen across Europe from Brexit to the upcoming referendum in Italy, across the board with the French presidential elections, the Dutch parliamentary elections, they seem to be scoring win after win, and they seem to be looking at potential wins on the horizon in the future. Why are they so successful now, and why were they so unsuccessful?
Well, I will answer, but first let me push back against your premise in things like Brexit and so forth. They are wins for Russia in many ways, but they're not wins in which I actually think Moscow had any hand in. It's just at the moment the West is gleefully tearing itself apart in so many ways.
And they are helping. They are helping.
They are nudging and egging on. But again, there's very little evidence that they actually have much traction in these things. But anyway, insofar as they do, I mean, clearly they do, and clearly they believe they do, because they're still willing to put a lot of money and effort into doing this. The reasons why it's different now from then are several. First of all, ironically enough, they have less to lose. The Soviet Union had a lot to lose. It was a superpower locked in this extraordinary conflict of ideology, but also the potential for thermonuclear Armageddon with the United States. And actually what then happened instead is most of the real conflict got pushed out into proxy conflicts around the world. Mm. Afghanistan, Latin America, Southern Africa, and so forth. Now, at the moment, Russia is extending itself to, in effect, fight a proxy war in Syria and another one in Ukraine. But basically, this is not a country which is capable of launching a kind of global challenge. What is the point exactly? At the moment, in some ways, precisely because Russia is the scrappy outsider, it's willing to take risks that the gerontocratic but also long-term planners of the old Soviet Kremlin were not necessarily willing to do. So that's reason number one. Reason number two is that the world is completely different. Back in those days, essentially the two blocs were largely
hermetically sealed.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you think of the sort of contact points, I mean, you know, economy, yes, there was obviously a certain amount of trade, and that was always sort of harnessed through a handful of organizations like Vnešne ekonombank and so forth, Vneshtorg. You know, so it was definitely, it was controlled by the center. There wasn't anything like the sort of the interplay of ideas and people and money that was taking place. You know, we now are in a barrierless society, and that gives the insurgent a whole lot of opportunities. And the third thing is precisely that because Russia has not for so long been seen as a threat, in a way, the West has not built up anything like the kinds of barriers and defenses mm-hmm. that we saw in the Soviet era. I mean, in some ways, the parallel, you know, we think of the Cold War and we think of the 60s and the 70s and even the early 80s. If anything, we're more like the late 40s and early 50s Cold War, when the rules were not yet in existence, when Russia was breaking what rules there were, left, right and center, when the West was still powerless and undecided and, okay, we're not engaged in reconstruction after a catastrophic war. But nonetheless, we certainly are not necessarily looking eastwards and thinking that is our biggest challenge mm-hmm. in a way that later we would.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk also about the weapons of the war. I like your distinction between polite people and impolite people. The former, obviously, being the Spetsnaz, and the latter being the militias and mafias, if you will, or warlords, militias and mafias. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, again, interesting. This is one of the things. If you're an insurgent power and you're willing to break the rules, then all the old definitions of combatant, non-combatant, acceptable and unacceptable forms of war don't really apply. Or if they apply, they're just ones in which you're aware that there's an additional cost involved in taking certain options. And the thing that we see that is absolutely clear is the extent to which Russia is looking to a whole variety of non-state actors as potential allies, often allies of convenience rather than conviction. But nonetheless, you know, whether it's we're talking about the so-called local self-defense auxiliaries that popped up in Crimea, mm-hmm. who are clearly local gangsters just given an armband and a Kalashnikov, or whether we're talking about the warlords of the Donbass, who are, again, in many cases, really just thugs and opportunists seeing their opportunity. Or else if we look, we're beginning to see evidence that the Russian intelligence apparatus is looking to organize crime, particularly Russian-based organized crime, obviously, but not exclusively, in North America and in Europe as potential instruments that they can use. So it's this general point of what they're trying to do is just simply find people who either are dissatisfied with the status quo or just don't care mm-hmm. and use them for whatever purposes they can.
Now, you also talk about weaponizing civvy street. This is something. This is one of my hobby horses, the using finance and corruption as a weapon. And we alluded to that a little mm-hmm. bit more. Did anything in here jump out at you or surprise you in this?
I mean, I think what it really speaks to is the extent to which, and this is something that time and time again, talking to people in Moscow really became quite alarmingly clear, is that as far as the Russian security apparatus and security elites are concerned, Russia is already at war. And it's a war that we started, but the point is Russia is at war. This is not just simply an era of competition, or call it what you will. It's war. And as in all wars, you look to mobilize all your resources, because this is not just some little skirmish. This, from Russia's point of view, is an existential struggle. Now, I mean, people like Andrew Monaghan of Chatham House have written really good stuff on how Russia has been looking to mobilize all the assets in military terms. Well, in a way, I actually just seek to try and extend it and think, well, okay, well, what actually Russia is doing is looking to mobilize its total national resources. And so that means, yes, of course, it means business, it means news structures, it means computer hackers, it means anything that can have a function. I'm reminded of in the old Soviet system, when their military was based around the idea of a mobilization military. You know, it wasn't just enough to have 5 million men or whatever under arms. You had to be thinking of the day where you might need 20 or 40 million men. And so every single truck and lorry in the whole Soviet Union had its Autokolomka designation. Mm. So that in theory, I mean, we know what Soviet organization is like, whether it would have happened. But no, in theory, every single truck had a place within the grand mobilization plans. If they needed to, they could use everything with wheels.
Right.
Well, in some ways, what we actually see now is a sort of a similar process of, an inventorying of all of the potential assets that Russia has at its disposal, and an attempt to think, how can this be used? And not all the time. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of, the same way as we saw recent case of a Russian espionage officer in New York who was working for a Russian bank. Now, it's not that every Russian bank is packed to the gills with spies or anything like that. But what it means is that, you know, any Russian institution or organization has to realize or be made to realize that there may well come a point when the state will say, we require you to do something, and this is not sort of an option. This is, in effect, the way that the Kremlin is conscripting every aspect of Russian society.
Now, I've talked a lot about the weaponization of corruption, and that, I mean, I wrote a piece arguing that corruption is the new communism in a lot of ways. And I that wasn't just a cute headline. I actually believe that what Putin's trying to do is to spread a Eurasian-style business space as far west as possible. Do you see evidence of this? Because I think they do want to spread this kind of kleptocratic, cronyistic model as deep into the West as possible, because with that comes control. When you corrupt somebody, you can control them. I don't think the goal is just to distract, disrupt, confuse, and render impotent the West to resist Russia's designs on the former Soviet space, if you will, because that's how it's often presented. Mm-hmm. I think actually there's a more active goal to spread this kleptocratic model as deep into Europe as possible. Would you agree with
that? I'd agree, but I think it still fits in with this thing. It's not like they actually think that they're going to be able to take control of countries through kleptocracy and through state capture or whatever. If nothing else, Russia doesn't have the resources to do so. I mean, they might be able to, you know, even if one looks at somewhere like Bulgaria, well, basically a quarter of GDP is in one way or the other connected to Russia. Even there, actually, you know, I don't think there's any prospect of Russia becoming in charge of the country. More generally, yes, though, absolutely they want to sort of spread this, because the more, again, in some ways it's a metaphor for what they're also trying to do with the world system. They want to undermine and subvert the international order. They want to turn it back to a 19th century realm in which might makes right, and if you can get away with it, that's fine. Well, likewise, in some ways, that's what they're trying to do on an individual, national, social, and kind of collective basis, is to undermine the norms, the rules, which are there, after all, to buttress the
including the business and finance and
ethical rules. Precisely, exactly, because that's where they're going to have most traction. Again, not because they think, oh, well, that way we're going to take over, but because that way they acquire active and inactive agents. I mean, I think the thing that strikes me is, on the one hand, you clearly have people who basically become knowing and, shall I say, tasked Russian agents. They wouldn't necessarily use those terms, but basically they're bought and paid for, and therefore they do Moscow's bidding. But then there are also people who carefully are given the opportunity to enrich themselves or flatter their ego by working with Russia, who then actually have their own incentive to precisely lobby against sanctions, lobby against further measures against Russia, to encourage other people also to do business and such like. And from Russia's point of view, from Moscow's point of view, the glory of this is They don't actually have to tell these people what to do. These people are going to go out there and actively do it. And we see this in London, for example, you know, where clearly there is a minority, but a very assiduous minority of people within the financial sector, within certain aspects of the legal and indeed property sort of communities, who very much lobby for a more emollient position towards Moscow. Without anyone from the embassy saying, comrade, this is what you do, it's precisely because they're thinking, there is money in this for me, and that's what I'm all about.
Now, looking at the landscape now, and whether or not, how much of a hand Moscow had in things like Brexit, or in the rise of Marine Le Pen in France, who will be facing another pro-Moscow candidate, François Fillon, most likely in the second round of the French elections. Nobody's expecting the left to do much in the first round. We're coming up in March with an election in the Netherlands with a far-right party expected to do very well. We have the election of a pro, what appears at the time to be a pro-Russian administration in the United States. How close are they to achieving that goal? Because they look really, how alarmed should we be at this point?
Look, I think that, we have to be very careful quite what pro-Russian means in a lot of these contexts. You know, even if one characterizes the sort of impending American administration as being pro-Russian, all it essentially means is that you might say it is less willing to precisely take a hard line against Russia. It's not as if they actually think we really want to do favors for Moscow or anything. And I think that applies to a lot of these other things. I mean, what we currently have is, for me, a very real risk that precisely that the West's will and capacity to prevent Russian aggression in its own neighborhood will diminish. This is not a fun time to be Ukraine or even Georgia or Moldova or in some ways Lukashenko. But in terms of actually the European Union, in terms of North America, I think that we're still talking about a generation of politicians who are still patriots, even if they're patriots who do not regard Russia as being a threat.
But we see the European Union at more risk than it's ever been since its founding, actually. I mean, if you have a Le Pen win in France...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the European Union may well suffer. Now, whether one regards that as necessarily something that makes Europe more open to Russia or less, I think is an interesting area for discussion. I couldn't exactly describe the European Union as a bastion of energetic and effective campaigning against Russia, despite the fact of its role with the sanctions regime.
No, but Putin clearly prefers to deal with individual states on a bilateral basis, not with a bloc. I think that the European Union as such, as an idea, represents something of a domestic political problem for Putin that he feels he needs to eradicate, the model of consensual integration, the model of transparent governance. And despite all the criticisms within the EU, it is very transparent when compared to the alternative to the East. He seems closer to that goal than ever.
Yeah, well, but let me make two points. One is, in terms of Putin and the EU, I agree absolutely that he regards the European Union as a model, as a concept, as a true normative challenge to his model. So I agree with you completely there. But the other thing is, yes, while Putin likes the idea of bilateral relations, again, that goes back to his 19th century view of the world, as we've discussed in other contexts, in some ways he might actually need to be more careful about what he wishes for. Mm. For example, in many ways, the European Union acts actually as a constraint on Poland, which is clearly, on the one hand, has ambitions towards sort of central, being in some ways being the Germany of Central Europe. And I think it is fair to say he's not especially keen on Moscow. And actually, I mean...
But Poland by itself is not going to represent Poland any kind itself, of realistic threat to Russia.
No, but on the other hand, actually, if, for example, I mean, there's always talk of this sort of intermarium types of thing, which at the moment is a non-starter. But you might say if the European Union dissolved or just simply became essentially meaningless, which I'm vaguely...
You're not there yet.
We're quite some way away from being there. But,
I think we're a couple of elections away from being there. But.
Well, maybe. I mean, if they're the right elections. But if that happened, then actually, in a way, the scope for different and in some ways a little bit more innovative but also much more explicitly anti-Russian structures emerge. The thing is, The European Union has, it's such a cliche to talk about within its DNA, but I think it's fair to say, within the European Union's DNA is a desire to avoid conflicts and confrontations. It really is all about negotiation and mediation. Mm-hmm. And that gives a great advantage to someone who basically doesn't care about consensus, as in Putin. He's always in that position that he can push that a little bit further, seek to hope that he can make one more, get one more concession out of them in the name, I mean, one can just look at the Normandy talks, frankly, you know, in the name of, oh, well, there might be an agreement a little bit somewhere down the line. Actually, if the European Union was no longer a factor in Europe, he might well actually breed precisely a similar bloody-mindedness amongst his neighbours. Which, again, I think would be problematic. Obviously, this is just science fiction. We're just trying to kind of postulate.
Not quite science fiction.
Well, it's near future.
A lot of things have happened in the last year that I would have considered science fiction before, but...
Well, welcome to the science fictional universe. But the thing is that actually when it comes down to it, I mean, you know, what Russia has demonstrated time and time again is that it's better at destroying than creating. It can create chaos. It can't necessarily build anything out of it. I mean, one can just look at the Donbass.
Right.
It's a sort of classic case in point. Well, likewise, I mean, I think the thing is there the possibility that Russia could help, given that anyway there is an existing massive centrifugal pressure within Europe at the moment? Could Russia just be that, you know, that 1% that tips the balance? You know, you think if you can move an election by 2%, well, that's the Brexit margin.
Yes.
It could do that, but the point is it's... opportunities to actually take its instruments and use them in a way to ensure that the Europe that emerges is one that is more, shall I say, Russia-friendly, that's much, much less certain. Because on the one hand, yes, of course, it's got a certain amount of corruption and so forth, but so much of its instrumentalization, particularly of non-military means, depends precisely on the other person having rules and the other person following the rules. If actually... countries decided that they're willing to just throw Russians out on the suspicion that they were spies without necessarily having proof. If countries were willing to massively sanction individuals and to freeze and confiscate bank accounts of anyone associated with Russia. Again, the sort of things that you might well do in wartime. If the West had the same kind of wartime perspective, and I sound terribly hawkish advocating this. It's certainly not that I would want to push us into a real war, but we need to be serious about this. And if a post-EU Europe might actually then precisely regard itself as being more under threat from Russia and therefore more willing to basically adopt these kind of wartime measures, that certainly would be very bad for Putin and very bad for the Russian elite, which in turn would be bad for Putin.
So he may be mistaken by wanting to party like it's 1815.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. The thing about 19th century geopolitics are it's great when you're the king. It's great when you're on top. But then what happens when precisely you no longer have that position? Ask the Ottomans. Ask the Habsburgs.
Right. I think what he's hoping for is to have regime, something to use the 1815 analogy farther, something akin to the Holy Alliance, which is some like-minded people in the major capitals of Europe. I mean, I think that's what he's certainly hoping for. This backing of the far right in Europe, I think, is aimed at that. I think this backing of the, you know, this support of so-called traditional values is aimed at that, at getting back to something like that, where you have like-minded great powers that decide the fates of everybody else, no?
Well, yeah, but again, I mean, imagine a Putin-like figure in Berlin. Mm. Would that person actually think... I think that Russia is a useful ally, or would that person actually think Russia is at best a problem or maybe an opportunity? It's hard to kind of predict the fan of possibilities. But given that these far right figures often tend to be populists, they tend to have an aggressive nationalist approach. And they don't have, unlike the sort of the Holy Alliance, there is no obvious other threat against which to justify themselves. The when it comes down
ISIS
to it...
ISIS is what he's trying to push.
Well, but. Yeah, but, I mean, yes, of course, ISIS. But the question is whether you really think that Russia actually is that useful. Anyway, look, Russia has to attack ISIS for its own reasons, particularly as we're now, as we come closer to the thought that ISIS is going to be... delivered a substantial blow in Iraq and quite possibly also in Syria. We're going to see more of these boys coming home. And that's going to be a real challenge for Moscow. In some ways, you only have power in this respect if you can credibly say, or I won't play ball. That's all. That's been Putin's card up to now. Well, increasingly, actually, the real threat from ISIS is not actually going to be in Paris or in Brussels or in Berlin. It's going to be in Rostov-on-Don, and it's going to be in due course in Moscow.
Okay, before we move on to the last part, I want to move to the Что делать part, the what is to be done, because you do have a section of recommendations of how the West should respond to this hybrid war threat. So what do you recommend?
Well, I think, again, it really sort of goes back to what I was saying. I mean, one is just kind of appreciate actually how the Russians see this, not because we have to sort of agree with it, but nonetheless we have to understand how they see the world and how they see these various instruments working. As I said, that really means that we then have to think much, much more seriously about non-kinetic defences.
I mean, I've been pushing for non-kinetic containment.
Containment
is
important.
Moving in that direction.
Yeah, I think. I mean, containment, but in a way, in some ways, more broadly, containment could only emerge after we had already established our own defences through deterrence and other means. So, in a way, what we need to think about is, because the best way of deterring these kind of political warfare operations is not to threaten to do it ourselves, in my opinion. I mean, that certainly has a temptation, but I think there's a risk in that it becomes a challenge and who knows where we go. It's actually the biggest threat from Russia's point of view is that they will try it and fail. They will throw resources and effort and fail. So what we do need to do is actually strengthen the internal, shall we say, hybrid defences, above all of Europe, but also of North America. And that means, yes, of course, spending our 2% of GDP on the defence as is kind of required or...
But that's kinetic.
Strongly indicated on kinetic. But because kinetic, I mean, the Russians have understood this, that you can use your military force for political purpose. You know, if you look at, you know, all those bomber flights that go around sort of through and close to Western airspaces, it's not because they're about to try and bomb something if we don't scramble an interceptor. It's to keep us worried. If you look at the threats they make, you know, recently they're talking about moving missiles, Iskander missiles to Kaliningrad. It's not actually because that has a real military meaning. It has a political meaning. So I think what the Russians have understood, I call this heavy metal diplomacy, is that you can use military force for political purposes. Well, so too can we. By doing that, not only do we actually buttress our defences in a way that we ought to, but it also actually sends a signal of reassurance to European populations and a signal to Russia that, you know, we are not to be messed with. You shouldn't think of us weak. But the point is, that's not where it has to end.
Right.
We then have to think beyond that. In some ways, just as warfare has become so much more complex and broader concept this century, we realize that actually, for some countries, forensic accountants and counterintelligence officers are actually going to be a far, far more formidable defense than a few more tanks. And that's what I think we need to look to. We actually need to look to shoring up all these internal weaknesses of our systems.
This whole of government approach, if you will.
Exactly. And that's something that where the European Union can actually make a positive role, rather than trying to sort of get into talking about, you know, European military structures and so forth. You know, it should accept that NATO does that and does that very well. But the EU is all about governance. And so many of these weaknesses and so many of these opportunities are within the realm precisely of governance.
You mean in terms of the corruption, the weaponization of finance and so on?
Absolutely.
And in terms of the information, so much ink's been spilled on that. But it seems to me that seems like a job for the journalism profession. It doesn't even seem to me like there's things that states can actually
It's journalism profession and schools and so forth. I mean, in a way, the problem is that we have a generation who are imbibing all this new media without having been trained in how to appreciate it and understand it and realize what its weaknesses are. I'm always a little bit worried about a response that seems to start from the principle of, you know, the problem is the population just doesn't really understand the world, and as long as we explain it to them. But I think there is a point that it's amazing and horrifying that people really don't understand the difference between just some website that might look impressive, but is essentially just simply repeating bizarre conspiratorial nonsense. And this doesn't, and let's be honest, most of this has nothing to do with Russia. I mean, this is a sort of a generalized problem about the information space in the world today, and useful and usable information. So, I mean, I think we need to have sort of journalists sort of be more aware of this. We need to have newspapers and other platforms more aware of this. But above all, it's populations that really need
the
to
news
be something.
Consumers.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
News producers. Okay, on that note, we'll move on to the second part. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and take a look at Vladimir Putin's annual State of the Nation speech. What message was the Kremlin leader trying to send to Russia and to the world? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Eliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of a new report, Hybrid War or Gibridnaya Vayna, Getting Russia's Nonlinear Military Challenge Right. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Владимир Владимирович Путин.
Добрый день, уважаемые. Борьба с коррупцией – это не шоу. Она требует профессионализма. Серьезно. Мы не ищем и никогда не искали врагов. Мы столкнулись с попытками и внешнего давления. Уже дважды говорил об этом. Было пущено все. От мифов про российскую агрессию.
He said the battle against corruption isn't a show. He called for the elimination of censorship in the global information space. He claimed that Russia is not seeking and has never sought enemies. And he accused the West of using targeted disinformation campaigns and propaganda against Russia, adding that we are tired of it. Vladimir Putin's big State of the Nation speech was an interesting bit of verbal jiu-jitsu. But what kind of message was he sending to the world? My take was that we should expect more of the same. There was a lot of triumphalism in this speech. It was seen as low-key. It was seen as lackluster, but I saw a lot of triumphalism. And one thing that really, really jumped out at me, I touched on it in the morning vertical today, is that Putin boasted that Russia is immune from the populist threat sweeping the West because the Russian people, in their infinite wisdom, understand that togetherness and unity are better than division, leaving aside the fact that Russian elections are completely fixed and that Russia's been doing everything it can to foster division in the West. What was your take, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I felt that it was a performance that was subdued to the point where, frankly, even he sounded bored, which it was only fair. Yeah, I mean, there was no real vision in this. There was nothing. It was quite interesting that we'd been told by Dmitry Peskov, presidential spokesman, that this was going to be a sort of different type of speech. And in some ways it was, because precisely it had nothing to it, really. There was no sense of a key message. I mean, even the sort of the triumphalism that you describe, I mean, to me, I felt it was complacency. I mean, particularly the notion that the Russians are immune to populism. I mean, that definitely sounded to me more like
that was
in
the very first part of the speech. Yeah. Where he was talking about the Duma elections, and he was implicitly contrasting the kind of calm Duma election, the election nobody, remember, we discussed it right afterwards, the election very few people came to vote in, and which produced a supermajority for the ruling party, and the kind of wild elections we've been having in the West that have been producing anti-establishment figures. And Russia's immune to this because, you know, and it wasn't an accident. This was the beginning of the speech. He was trying to set the tone. I agree with you. He did look bored, though.
No, I mean, I mean, and certainly I'd also agree that this sort of he is enjoying positing the fact that Russia is so different from the West. And again, this is one of these kind of classic Putin tactics that in the West, when they're not busy sort of requiring everyone to be gay or sort of, you know, stealing children to be adopted by gay couples or all doing other sort of dissolute things, they are busy tearing each other apart with this sort of this lunacy that is Western style democracy compared with the managed democracy of sovereign democracy and so forth. Yeah, that's true enough. But you know, we've heard all of this before. If the best thing you can boast about is that basically your own population is so disillusioned with politics that they don't even bother getting involved and getting excited, well, that's rather sad. Interestingly, on this whole business of division, I mean, that was the only sort of point where he touched on the fact that next year is the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution was a little sideswipe at no one should bring up the old, you know, bitternesses and divisions of the past.
Yeah, I thought that was telegraphing how they're going to handle
it. Yeah, exactly. It was this, I mean, essentially, I mean, right after it, I mean, my sort of tweet was basically this was keep calm and carry on.
Yeah.
Repeated for 70 minutes.
And do you think that is a function of complacency, triumphalism, or is there beneath the surface here, as you suggested in the Facebook post yesterday, that maybe there's kind of they don't know what to do yet because there are storm clouds on the horizon for this regime?
Yeah, I mean, look, what else have they got? I mean, okay, he was able to talk about agricultural productivity being up.
Spent a lot of time on social issues.
Yeah, but the point is, social issues, that's fine. So you talk about how important it is. But then we look at the budget. Then we look at the budget in which 30% of all federal spending is going on defence, policing and domestic security. And social questions, education and so forth are getting around sort of 3% or less. I can't remember some of the exact figures. This is not clearly a regime that actually is serious about these issues on which it talks. And there is a risk if you talk too much about issues on which you're actually not planning on doing anything. But I think, again, when it comes down to it, there were no real successes to triumph. The closest thing to successes that he could point to, really, were the West is having a crisis and everything is quiet here at home.
And we're not yet, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he's also even trying to provide reassurance to the elites. I mean, his point about the corruption campaign, it's quite interesting because, again, there had been suggestions in advance. What I thought was actually a very good post by Pavel Bayev from James.
Yeah, that was a good post.
I agree with him. I mean, he was saying that he thought that corruption was going to become more sort of front and centre.
So did I. I was surprised. Wasn't. It was a couple of lines.
Exactly.
Really,
I mean, so, and even then, the lines that there were, they seemed to be couched in way to try and reassure the elite. Because after the Ulyukayev arrest, there was clearly a sense that, oh my God, they're basically going to be coming after the liberals now,
right,
and such like. Well, this was very much, I think, it's a proper anti-corruption campaign, but it means it'll be done procedurally and carefully. Yeah, I think that was an attempt to dampen things. Again, this we have. It's Putin, you know, late model Putinism based upon essentially soporific qualities more than anything else. He just wants everything to be nice and calm as far as he can.
And foreign affairs was not mentioned. It was more than a half hour into the speech before he even mentioned, for 40 minutes, it was deep into the speech before he mentioned foreign affairs. And foreign affairs got almost no attention.
I mean, beyond just simply the kind of ha-ha look at the West, what can he talk about? He can't talk about covert subversion, because that's the whole point about covert subversion. There haven't really been any triumphs. China, you know, there's a few references, but basically China is not coming over as Russia's greatest friend and banker. And what he said, I mean, even in the context of the new foreign policy doctrine that's just come out that we were talking about beforehand off mic, there's a few tweaks in terms of language, but basically there's nothing much else to be said. It's a question of just sitting back and hoping things work out all right.
Now, I thought it was interesting that the foreign policy doctrine came out right after the speech. It wasn't telegraphed. It had some, like you said, some tweaks. I noticed a couple of tweaks. One is that they would be resisting U.S. attempts for extrajudicial application of its laws. That it would resist the application of so-called humanitarian interventions. Translation: we will stand up for the Assads of the world. The former was don't touch the Victor Boats of the world. But there was some slight tweaks. How did you read into all of this? I mean, this is a Kremlin that's very careful about its messaging. So what were they doing yesterday?
Yeah, well, again, I mean, I can't help but feel that, I mean, I don't know, but to release your foreign policy doctrine, your new foreign policy doctrine, on the same day as the presidential address feels a little bit like taking out the trash day. It's precisely you don't want people spending too much time looking at it and parsing it and understanding it. I mean, I can't honestly understand why they bothered with a new doctrine, because it's the old doctrine, and it also just talks about things they were doing anyway. But the interesting thing was there was just one particular sort of, again, phrase that I think for me sort of sums up when they're talking about their relationship with the United States on the basis of equality, mutual respect for interests, and non-interference in the internal affairs of each other. I mean, that for me, that single sentence is in some ways the essence of Russia's current foreign policy. They want equality. They want America to treat Russia as an equal. But of course, it patently is not on any terms other than thermonuclear capacity. Mutual respect for interests. Well, that is just basically a coded way of saying we have a sphere of interest.
Right.
You need to recognize that and basically allow us that. And we won't care if you want to get involved in Latin America or, frankly, anywhere else in the world. As far as they're concerned, frankly, Europe is America's sphere of influence, that basically European countries are just simply American proxies and clients. So give us Ukraine and all the others. And that last bit, non-interference in the internal affairs of each other. And again, that comes back to what that basically says is, you don't get to tell us how to run our system. You don't get to tell us that it's wrong for us to imprison journalists or break the law or whatever. Again, back to the 19th century, the view that of absolute sovereignty, even over notions of international law, human rights, etc.
But what's left unsaid there is the or else we will interfere in yours. And this coming on the heels of the hacking attacks during the U.S. election is a threat with some teeth. No?
Yeah, I mean, anyway, if we flip it around, I mean, this is, as it were, the Russian concept of deterrence. Precisely. We can do this to you, so don't do it to us. Because the trouble is, again, despite all evidence to the contrary, they still believe that the West is actively trying to do that. Every time the West, says something nice about Navalny, supports investigative journalism in Russia, or does anything like that. Every time the European Court of Human Rights actually says something about Russia when it breaks the law, what they're thinking of is, it's these bloody Westerners again trying to interfere, trying to undermine. Because when you've got a system which is precisely based on authoritarianism and corruption, then any attempt to apply law is intrinsically subversive.
Right. Now, one thing I read into the subdued nature of this, both the speech and the slight updates in the foreign policy doctrine, is all I could keep thinking was that we're basically in a holding pattern right now. I mean, I think the Kremlin is kind of waiting to see what the Trump administration is going, what kind of posture the Trump administration is going to take toward it. It's waiting to see how all these elections in Europe pan out. We have the Italian referendum, which could lead to the fall of the government. Coming up shortly. We have the Dutch, as I said, the Dutch elections, the French elections, and then at the end of next year, the German elections. I think they're kind of in a holding pattern, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd actually throw some more things into that. This is why I think 2017 is going to be a really pivotal year. Obviously, we have the sort of unknown communist factor at home. The economy. 2017 is meant to be the year when finally, after all sorts of stops and starts, the Russian economy may well actually begin to grow, even if by the most pettily small amounts. So again, I think there is that point of just waiting to see. And, you know, is the oil price sort of boost that we're seeing at the moment with the OPEC deal, is that going to last? And all these various factors. 2017, I think, is a year that is full of, sadly, opportunities for the Putin regime, but also a whole variety of potential risks. So, yeah, at the moment, it's just damp things down, keep things quiet. Let's see in a year's time, I think, is the sort of the essence of the Putin message to his own, if not to the ordinary Russian people. Let's see in a year's time what state we're in, because then, of course, we'll be into the run-up to 2018 presidential elections,
right,
which are what really it's all about.
And we'll have one more set piece before the year's out with Putin's big press conference before the year's over, because this and the speech tend to come one after another.
But what I think this speech does suggest is that the thought that there was going to be some kind of dramatic shift coming soon, whether it was Putin stepping down for reasons of ill health, whether it was some kind of reshaping of the basis of the political system and the governance or anything like that, or indeed a really serious fight against corruption within the system. I think all of these ideas, I don't think they're entirely mythical, but I suspect that they've all been played out behind the scenes. People have thought them through, and in each case they've decided that the risks in doing anything outweigh the potential opportunities, and therefore they've simply again decided just to hunker down and wait what happens. And again, that is the essence of Brezhnevism. The essence of Brezhnevism is when you think actually the world is too scary to try and do anything about it.
So it's kind of the calm before the storm or the calm before the stagnation?
Well, I think it is the stagnation. I mean, I think this is the
stagnation
thing.
Before the storm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we'll find out. Unfortunately, stagnations can last quite some time. But definitely, I mean, I think for me, this really emphasized it was a regime that has no ideas or not the courage to actually apply any of them.
But a regime that thinks it's winning for the time being.
I'm not sure. Again, this is it, whether it's triumphalism. I mean, he has to say, you know, no politician is going to do a State of the Union and not say, oh, we're doing fine. But I really don't get this. I don't get the feeling of Trumpism. They're really happy internationally what's happening.
Yeah, they're happy internationally.
They're delighted that. What they're doing is working. The point is, when it comes down to it, actually what happens in elections in Holland, yeah, in due course may have some cascade impact directly for Russia.
What happens in elections in France will have a big cascade
impact. It'll have a cascade effect, but it'll do it on geopolitics. And frankly, the most likely sort of positive outcome is an end of sanctions.
The end of sanctions.
And
that
is
not... job number one right now is getting those sanctions.
That's not really a major impact, though, on how things are in Russia, on the streets and sort of for ordinary Russians. I think actually, you know, given the current trend we see within the economy, with regional debt, with the awful drain that Donbass represents. I mean, in fact, there is a whole new oblast that they're having to maintain while pretending that it doesn't exist on the books. Right. You know, for all these reasons, actually, I think that however much satisfaction they're getting at what's going on in the West, I do think there's serious concerns at home.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll wait and see. And on that note, we shall wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of a new report, Hybrid War or Gibridnaya Vojna, Getting Russia's Non-Linear Military Challenge Right. I have my copy, so be sure to get yours. Thanks, Mark, for an interesting discussion.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.